So again, we're in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 through 22 this morning. We'll be reading that text together in just a second. Our goals, again, are designed with a couple of primary purposes. Goal number one, whenever we read the scriptures, is to come to a better understanding of whom God is. And that's on the idea or premise that our relationship is reflective of that. That we are made in God's image, and knowing more about God then also then informs us about ourselves, both spiritually and physically. Beyond that big goal of things, a sense of who we are and where we're going, we get to dig deeper into messages that have unique purposes and unique audiences. The purpose of Ephesians has intent behind it to these Christians at Ephesus, who in many ways may share experiences with us, both on their lives and their current spiritual condition, but also Paul, through God and Christ, is seeing their future as well. What they can become, whom they are, whom we are. And there's a large image that takes place maybe the last half of chapter 1 that really goes into the beginnings of chapter 2, where God is talking about his treasure, his wealth, his goodness being poured out to humankind. And we talked about this last week and a little bit 2 weeks ago as well, that sometimes it is difficult to quantify what spiritual riches are given our limitations. Individually and corporately as humankind, we don't do well in figuring out big, vast things, and especially things that aren't touch, taste, feel, see. We struggle with trust, and trust beyond the edges of our perception. As an example of a way to think about that, I think most of us could conjure up the idea of what $10 bills stacked on top of each other would look like, right? I know most of us probably don't use dollar bills like we used to, but we know what they look like, feel like. And would you say that's a lot of money? $10 stacked up as singles? It's not really a lot. It is, because look, you could probably still get a good meal or two out of it, right? You can go to a grocery store, and if you shop wisely, two, maybe three meals. So it's nothing to sneeze at. And if you had found $10 on the side of the road, and you knew it was just laying there, and there's no way you could track it back to its owner, that's 10 bucks. What if it was 10 $100 bills? So now we got $1,000. Now we're talking real money? We're absolutely talking real money in my world. I can still conceptually figure out what that is. I can see it. I can understand it. What about $1,000 bills? Now we got real money, right? You know that money is heavy if you start getting large quantities of $100 bills? Like, it's not just easy to walk around with. It's cloth, not paper. It starts stacking up in weight. What about 10,000 $100 bills? Or 1,000 stacks of $100? That's hard to conceptualize, right? What if it was $1 billion in bills? Could you carry that around?
No.
Absolutely not. I'm not even quite sure how many people it would take to split it up to carry it from a weight and space ratio. But if someone wants to math that out, totally interesting thing to figure out. Way more than one person, way more than two, way more than four. Might even start filling up rooms at that point to have $1 billion in $100 bills. But even then, $1 billion, I can kind of conceptualize what $1 billion can accomplish. But $100 billion, $1 trillion, the largest number I know, a Googleplex, it's an actual number. That's a whole lot of number, right? It's a whole lot of money. So now we've reached the extent of our capacity to figure out earthly value, because we attach dollars to earthly value. So when God starts talking about "but God" in verses 1 through 10, change things up for us, acknowledges that we are then made in the image of God, and desires to redeem, to reconcile, to reinvigorate our relationship. And he says these are spiritual riches that are being given to us that far exceed our ability to quantify. That's going to be a moment for us to kind of pause and, as Paul does here, think backwards a little bit. So let's read together. We're going to read the entirety of chapter 2, verses 11 through 22. I'm going to arbitrarily break it up a little bit. And because I just saw Matt walk in, he gets to read because I can see him in person. And so let's go ahead and have you read, if you will, Matt, verses 11 through 15. And Adam, are you up to closing up the chapter for us? Back row sitter there. That's going to be chapter 2, verses 16 through 22. And so Matt will start, and then Adam will finish up the chapter.
Therefore, remember that previously you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the people of Israel, strangers to the covenants of the promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who previously were far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall, by abolishing in his flesh the hostility, which is the law composed of commandments expressed in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two one new person, in this way establishing peace.
Might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. He came and preached peace to you who were far off, and peace to those who were near. For through him we have both access in one spirit to the Father. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In him you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit.
Great job, guys. So you have this picture that's going to eventually be easier for us to grasp, a built physical thing. But it's going to require for us to work our brains to there, to like arrive at this destination. So we're thinking first three or four verses. Therefore, remember that at one time, you Gentiles in the flesh. And so it's one of those easy, rare instances where, it's quite certain that Paul is identifying me. He's not talking about those who are in Christ from a Jewish disposition, background, ethnically, spiritually. Gentiles now become the terminology. Gentiles as a category, that's you, me, and everyone we probably know. But he's not saying this in the sense of remember your flesh, remember your spiritual condition. Remember how far off you felt, the distance that was present. If you or I were in the first century and were able to, again, use Doc Brown's flux capacitor or any other means of time travel to go back in time, we would arrive there and not be able to get very close to the center of Jewish worship. This is a recreation of the temple space showing the mark-off line and one of the ways they would have demarked that Gentiles go no further. Even if you were saying, I'm a God-fearer, I believe in God. I believe in creation. I believe in everything that's recorded in the scrolls that you have. Still not allowed in. Ethnically, you're going to be kept at bay. And that level of exclusion is a key concept that separated Israel from the Gentile world. You're not one of us. Think deeply about what that can feel like in your own experiences, the places and situations that you've been in the past. Maybe even as simple as those childhood playground experiences where you start picking teams. I don't think I ever recall being picked last for basketball. Like, that's usually what the one space, like, yep, first pick. But there's a lot of things that that's not the case for me. If we started playing baseball, I don't know how well you field. Because I don't very well. I've got a great combo of two-thirds of a baseball game. I can hit really well. I can throw pretty well. I cannot catch with my left hand. Like, it's just atrociously bad, especially even more so when I was a kid. So, maybe if we have a designated hitter, you can play for us. Your own experience has probably had something like that, where you see everyone else be selected, everything else go away, but no, you're excluded. So, when Paul brings this image up, it's one of the ones that's going to sting a little in context, especially in the Roman world. But it should sting a little for us, but it also should be, I'm thankful. Because where I was once excluded, now I am going to be included. I was once an outsider to the nation, and now I'm afforded access to the inside space. Radical change in identity is going on in that regard, which is uncommon in the world then and now, to have such a capacity to shift whom you are and where you're at. It's a pretty big deal. So I've given a little bit of perspective. Let me scooch just a little bit forward, and we'll go to the second question on this. Why do you think Paul then wants us, the Ephesians, and all disciples to make these kind of reflections? What does it do for us to think about that past? Cecilia?
Well, it reminds us that we are now included, but it is also a reminder of the Jews that they are no longer the chosen, that the Jew and Gentile are both equal now.
Yeah, their purpose had been fulfilled as being a vessel for redemption, despite their misunderstanding of what that meant. They seemingly took their precious position as, I'm a vessel for what God has us as a mission, to now being I am a special, special child. And nothing else can affect me. And God is always for me and will always be for me. And nothing's ever going to change. And they kind of got off mission. Mission creep took over, and they said, us rather than God, in parts of that community. And so there's some of that there. I think also we could probably reflect well on what it means as to why we were separated. What was going on? What kind of lifestyle choices were in play? What kind of circumstances took place that said, ethically, spiritually, morally, I'm on the outside? There's a lot of that going on. Another thing to think about is the way in which the culture around them functioned. First century culture is rich with history bits and pieces to talk about how their lives functioned, especially in debt contexts. There's a large slave population in the first century. The source for those slaves is really only in two spots. Source number one is by conquest. They would enslave communities and bring them into servitude, much like the history of that region did. Rome gradually started to push off of that, because as they conquered, they also reallocated leadership and started to integrate these new communities, but they still needed a slave population. Their slave population that the second tier history of Rome brings in is a whole lot of indentured servitude. You're in such a level of debt that you cannot provide for yourself, so you sell yourself into slavery. And in the slavery context and the laws that existed in that situation were arranged in such a way that increasingly made it difficult for you to ever earn enough to pay off your debt. You just couldn't do it. By the way, that happened in every culture in its early histories. U.S. culture had a lot of that too, as a well of labor pool when our early arrival colonists came over. A lot of them were indentured slaves who just simply could never make enough to break free from their slavery. So they spent their whole life in that context. Does that feel like it is sometimes for us today too? Like you've made some financial choices that you're never going to escape and you're just never going to repay them? You can. Talk to enough folks. They feel that the choices they made are now still weighing over their shoulders and they'll never get free of them. So in the first century, to have a context where there was something you could do and completely change your identity and have a space where you could be completely free was absolutely weird. It's not the way that their culture functioned. Further, it became a bit of a mix of cultures. While the largest component of new Christians came from the lower caste, the lower class, poor or non-leading voices, the Bible record tells us that in every community there were often a few wealthy Christians who were providing. And so you'd never had that kind of interaction or access before, where you had people from here and here saying to each other, "We're actually right here." I didn't solve all the other stuff. That's a radical shift. And that's the same radical shift that's going on between Jew and Gentile. You were close to God. You were far from God. You were really all over all here. But now God is saying we actually all are right here. We're together. Independent of how we got here. We're grafted together. We are, as it says in the text, brought near by Christ's blood. So on a practical level, what does that term mean? It's metaphorical to a certain degree, but on a practical level, what takes place when these two very different communities, or even just two different individuals, are being brought near? What are some things that the blood of Christ accomplishes? We'll think about that on a practical level. Give me one easy one.
Pays
the debts. The debts in context are our sins. Another term is it washes away sin. It reconciles. It's another treasury / cash term that's being used here. It restores or repairs a relationship. It also is the motivating fuel for this terminology of being grafted back in for the Gentiles and the Jews. So they are all of one tree and one family again. And so the separation that was there is now being eradicated, put back together as one family, and it would include all the incumbent. It also means it can also include. It also should help us get together. Rich?
Maybe you said it when I missed it.
Yeah.
Right, redeemed, which is buying back or paying off whatever debt of that person. So redeemed, but I think one of the key things here is it's through Christ's blood. Nobody else is.
Yeah.
Only through Christ.
You know, I remember very clearly living in Temple Terrace, Florida, and saying, "I really want a TV. Because I want to watch a couple things." I'd gotten a little DVD player, a VHS thing. I wanted a TV to watch and get an antenna in our dorm room. And I'm like, "I can't afford a new TV." Where do you think I went and got one? Pawn shop. So someone failed to redeem their pawned television. And I redeemed it for cash. Far less than a new one. Weighed about 4,000 pounds. Moved that up to the third floor of the dorm. But I redeemed it. Set it free from its curse of holding in the building because somebody else needed the value of it. And I probably paid more for it than they got for it. Probably. Right? That is a bit of this practicality taking place, that someone's willing to pay more than we think it's worth to redeem it, to rescue it, to restore it. How should that then impact how we see everybody?
Everybody's in debt with their sins to start with.
Yep.
But it takes the same thing for everyone to be redeemed. Christ was that sacrifice for the redemption.
You know, a lot of times, you know, we look at things and we start saying, well, this is what I see. And if you see somebody driving a brand new Mercedes and they live in a brand new house, just finished all of it and got all of its payoff notes from the closeout notes from all the inspectors, and the city said it's brand new, it's safe to occupy, and they live there. Does that indicate that person has means, has money? It looks like it, right?
Not necessarily.
But it could come with crippling credit card debt and a huge mortgage that they're, underwater on. And what looks like wealth may not be wealth. Do we treat someone who has the fancy car and the brand new house differently than the person who lives in the mobile home and drives a 1980 Datsun? Datsun needs a truck's shifted age at that point. It's a small detail. Absolutely we do. We are trained that way to establish a perception that says, this person's got it, this person doesn't, so I treat the person this way. It doesn't mean we're right, but we're trained that way. This should help us acknowledge that reality in the congregational context and say, wait a minute, there's a space where I need to reevaluate. Now, it should roll everywhere else. And so part of what Paul is doing there for this church at Ephesus is reminding them that on the spiritual connections that really tie them together, the ones that will travel with them should they travel from where they are now to somewhere else, they're living in a different world than they used to. There's been some huge changes, some strong spiritual changes, partly because Christ has become our peace. It is a consequence of these big changes. He says he himself is our peace, our reconciliation, or our completion of things. In Christ, hostility between Jews and Gentiles has been broken down. A lot of times we think about the text of maybe Galatians, or thinking about the theological or doctrinal concerns between the division of new Christians who came from either a Jewish background or a Gentile world, the story of Peter as another part of those components in the book of Acts. We put those all together and we think, well, yeah, those are the primary texts to talk about that, because Paul addresses it clearly in Galatians, and there's a whole dialogue in the book of Acts. Well, here, there's a congregational context where they're being told, hey, look, Christ is the reason you are now at peace. There's a little edge of that. It's hard to capture in our current world. Partially because those who were living in Israel at that time frame and existing in that context, they, unlike our more multicultural world to a degree, physically look a lot more similar in the local inhabited space. Even though they're moved from different cultures to get where they're at, there's not a large visual change between what we would identify as the Philistines, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Mediterraneans. Those who inhabited Palestine physically don't look that much different than those who physically inhabited North Africa. And it takes someone to speak or act to figure those things out. But when they did, they fought. heavily. And leading up to the first century, in the times when the Bible is not articulating new history to us, that period between the close out of the Minor Prophets and the arrival of John, there's a series of attempts by the Jewish people to reassert their independence and to say, we are an independent nation, we want to be a king, a kingdom, and have our own king. And the Roman populace puts them down. Roman legions put them down over and over again. Some Christian converts in Ephesus, some Christian converts in Thessalonica, some in Galatia, are Roman soldiers who have their citizenship through service to the empire. So I want you to imagine someone who knowingly had a history in their lineage of service that, hey, our legion, we lost a lot of them to this uprising down in Israel 70 years ago, and it's part of our lore and history now. And now I worship with someone who used to be a Sadducee, used to be Pharisee, used to be a rebel, used to be someone willing to draw a sword to fight against the Roman Empire. Now we got to worship together. And from the outside, you guys look the same. They may actually look the same. They could have the very same genotypes. So there's a level here that is being expected of these new Christians, or even long-standing Christians, to continue to work through that distinct difference. And kind of helps us ask a question, what walls, cultural, personal, do we still feel exist in churches today? You ever feel like churches have cliques, that these little hub internal circles never interact with the other hub internal circles? If you did not shake and nod your head, you have not lived in places where there are larger congregations, more than three people. Because eventually, that's how it works in practical terms. Even when there's no intent. If you have two couples who have young kids, do you think they have far more in common than those two couples with young kids and these other three couples who have no kids and they're at the empty nest phase of life? If you call a couple with young kids and say, hey, do you want to go to the concert tonight? And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm tired, I'm going to bed because the kids just went to sleep. It's my first chance to sleep in 6 weeks. Right? That is a natural, normal human thing. Sometimes it can be abnormal, exclusionary, and disruptive. That's just one example of those things that can happen. You can easily stack two and three and four more, right? Is it hard to be a welcoming community to welcome new people in to your routine and circumstances? Yeah, it requires choice. Like, it's hard. Not because you don't want to. But let me illustrate it this way. It's a simple one. How many of you like it when the time changes? When the clock goes 1 hour one way or the other? You just wait for it, and you're super excited for it every year. I don't like it going either direction. I don't like losing the sleep. I don't like getting the sleep back. I don't like none of it. That's a 1 hour change. How much change exists when you throw one more person into a room? Just one human being.
Depends on the size of the room and the size of the crowd.
And the size of the person, right? And a little person can be a really big change. If you think back to arrival of children and families, just one new convert is one new child in the family. That changes everything else. The group is never the same as it was with one more voice. So you can think about it on a personal level, and the things that these are walls that I got, things that I have to get over. These are walls that I see that I got to figure out. How do I surmount the wall? How do I wait for the time when they're ready to call down and say, hey, come hang out? is that okay for me to do, or should I try something different on an individual level? You're thinking those things out. On a cultural level, you're doing that. Congregations have an ongoing culture that goes from the day it began until the day that God says the candlestick is no longer there. And it's a representation of the community that worships together there. And it will shift on some things. The easiest illustration of that that's really quick is the songbook you choose. Whether it's digital or print or otherwise, it's got a certain number of songs in it. And you know the ones you know. And you probably, in every songbook anywhere, most churches might use 10% of it. I'm being generous. There's like 800 songs in there, in most of them. And so 10% is pretty generous. Les, you think it's a pretty generous number at 10%? Yeah. It's hard to learn new songs. And so you got to have song leaders who can learn them and teach them. All of those things come into play. Those are surface level illustrations. You could probably pick a personal basket of challenges you've experienced that still exist. It doesn't matter what it is, it's still got something we got to work through. How do you fix a problem, by the way, that you know is a problem? Do you fix it by ignoring it?
Have to address it.
You got to figure out a way to address it. Whatever the problem is. Cecilia?
I was just going to say, you know, human nature, people don't like change. It's just human nature. And I guess he's talking to both Jews and Gentiles in this, saying, hey, look, what was once was is no longer, because Christ changed everything.
Yeah. These were people who were kind of propped into a position of being enemies in the past. It's not that like, oh, we just don't go to the same restaurants. Restaurants are kind of not a thing in this culture anyway. Often the difference between Jew and Gentile was heavily entrenched into worldview, spiritual things too. That's why there's this dialogue of the meat market in the Corinthian letters. Dietary change, status change, lifestyle change, sometimes a history of going to war with one another. Sometimes these new converts who are Gentiles could have been from provinces where conflict was ongoing between different groups, and now they're worshiping together. Slave and free worship together without change in status in the first century. So you stayed a slave, and yet you worship with freed people. All of that creates culture conflict and a risk of connection. Because if the free people are starting associating with the slaves, guess how they get treated? Slaves. Society doesn't care about an individual enough to say, oh, well, he's just hanging out there because of their religious preferences. That's no big deal. That worked for Paul. He was uniformly mistreated because of his convictions and preaching. And so they have to address it in the ways that are appropriate in the congregational context. And they're doing that in Ephesus, in part through the letter. And they would have to then follow up with these instructions too. Yeah.
To me, the best way to handle this is to get out of our own comfort zone, to reach into others and see how they're feeling, and just cross the line.
Yeah, here's a way to think about it, and Liz, that's a good perspective. It requires, using Roman letter imagery, those who are genuinely strong, not just the ones that think they're the strong ones, but actually are spiritually mature, to take the risk to those who are developing their faith and growing and saying, all right, I'm going to come into your space and support you. Even at times where I don't fully understand everything that's going on, and we'll talk about that too, and I will sit with you and listen to you and learn from you. That learning process then enables the strong to figure out what actual help needs to be given. Sometimes the help that is needed is just to sit there and let them continue to process and mature. Other times it's to ask direct questions, address it. Hey, I noticed that this is happening. I'm curious as to why. this is happening. Help me understand. Incrementally, you can then change the tables and let them ask the questions of you. And they might eventually ask you a question that hurts, because your behavior, your action may have actually hurt them too. That's part of the Roman correspondence back and forth. I got your horse too.
The story that keeps running through my mind as we're talking all of this out is the story of Ruth.
Yeah.
It's just kind of being played out here.
Yeah, by the way, if anyone ever asks you who's the best couple in the Bible, we get to see the whole story kind of play out. It's Ruth and Boaz, 100%. Especially the Old Testament. And I will fight that one if you want to have a real strong conversation about the best custom couple in the Old Testament. It's absolutely them, 100%.
Esther's up there too.
Yeah, but not the best couple. who she is married to isn't always that great. Norris?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, these Gentiles, at this time, they realized that they had the same spiritual assets and blessings as you. You can imagine how their feeling was. And I think here, Paul was trying to address and remind them of that.
Yeah, and that's like this. You have now equal access to God that you didn't before. Some of you are kept further away. God cared for all humanity, but some were kept further away because of the plan, because of their choices, all these components going together. But now we have access by one Spirit to the Father. That's intended to kind of get the picture of we are now family. That's not the outsider. We are all bound together. That's a hard shift. Maybe a little easier, though, for the Gentiles than for the Jewish perspective. They had a history of being able to work with other Gentiles. And in some cases, the Jewish contingent of congregation was a minority. And so some of these communities, it really shifted the other way, where they were the outsiders. How should or how does knowing this oneness in spirit affect how we relate to one another? Here's a simple context. How about in prayer? When you pray to the same God through the same unified Spirit, would that change how you pray for someone or what you pray in regards to their needs and conditions? Look through the Psalms. How many of the Psalms have them praying for calamity of others? Take down my enemies. Bring justice to them. Those imprecatory psalms, in some form or another, take about half the space of the literature. So having a same access to the same Father is a simple switch. I don't pray for their demise. I pray for their success. That's a huge change in that culture and context. It's a huge change in immediate context to pray for someone who used to be your enemy, but now you wish them well. It's a step towards a real relationship. It's a step towards maybe even more than they had before. And there's a sense of real building up that takes place in this, because the imagery that's being employed here is one of a physical structure again. So we've gone from hard to quantify, classify, back to cornerstone. Good set cornerstone is going to set the rows for the foundation for the entire structure. Most important step, right there. Good foundation. Every step off of that then is related to it. And so it's a big deal. Something that establishes that big piece when we think about this imagery of this new temple. By the way, this is a look, and I kind of skipped into this last chunk of the text here. Underneath the last bits of the Herodian retaining wall. So the time of Herod, when they expanded the temple, those extra flat spaces. Most of it's all been destroyed, but there's a little spot. If you've seen what they call the Wailing Wall on TV, and you can walk down to there, you turn left, and there's a little corridor, and you can get down underneath it, and you can see these big stones that create the standard by which the rest of it is all established. And so in that little corridor, you can go and see the chief cornerstones of that expansion. Paul takes that imagery, well known, well understood in the context of the world of that time frame, and says these are the ideas concerning Christ and their labor and himself. And so he describes the community of Christians as a building. That in that context, we are then supporting and sharing the load for each other. And we all have a part in that task. And in ways that we don't always fully capture or understand, both physically and spiritually, there are times when you are entirely carried by those around you, due to the interlocking nature of the structure of the body of Christ. And there are times when you may be carrying a load that feels like it's too much for you to bear. Again, for that same concept and purpose of the interlocking nature of the community of God. How does our knowledge of being part of a bigger kingdom change our life in this one? What do you worry about when you remember that you're part of a heavenly kingdom? Let me explore my phrase it this way. How many churches exist of similar theology and practice to what we're accustomed to in Ephesus? This many that I'm aware of. Largest city on the planet, Cairo, Egypt. How many churches that you would be comfortable worshiping at exist there? Two. And you know what? It's risky for you or I to go visit them, because we draw attention to their community of Christians, because we look so out the norm. And so if we arrive, everyone who isn't like them spiritually knows that now that's even more sure. And so if you go to Cairo and you want to visit the Christians there, you actually have to do it under the cover of darkness, in and out, for their safety as much for yours. Understanding you're part of a citizenship status of a kingdom that has a different set of borders changes your willingness to be accommodating in those areas. But it also might shift your perception of which kingdom stands, what kingdom really lasts. And as much as we think, well, yeah, Rome lasted, right? Did Rome die? Did the church in Rome die? All those bodies that were part of that in community lost their convictions at different times and made independent individual choices. And so as time goes, that's the transition of normalcy. Should shift your perspective of what kingdom matters, the kingdom of Rome or the kingdom of God. Thanks, everybody. We'll continue looking forward to the third chapter next week, looking at verses 1 through 13. Thanks.